Hello, and welcome to Screaming in the Cloud with your host, cloud economist Corey Quinn. This weekly show features conversations with people doing interesting work in the world of cloud, thoughtful commentary on the state of the technical world, and ridiculous titles for which Corey refuses to apologize. This is Screaming in the Cloud.
This episode of Screaming in the Cloud is sponsored by N2WS. There are a number of backup solutions that are available in AWS, including the recently announced AWS Backup. Well, AWS back the f*** up. Backups are incredibly easy. Restores, however, are absolutely not. You want to find out that your backups work well in advance, instead of the way that most of us do, when they don't work quite right, immediately after you really, really, really needed them to work correctly. Check them out at n2ws.com. That's n2ws.com. Thanks to them for supporting this ridiculous podcast. Welcome to Screaming in the Cloud. I'm Corey Quinn. I'm joined for a second time by Corey Sanders.
That's right. I think the second time's supposed to be better, but we'll see. No promises.
So they tell us. The last time that we chatted a year ago, here as well at Build, you were the corporate VP of Azure Compute.
That's right.
You're now the corporate VP of Microsoft Solutions. What is that?
You know what? When I figure it out, I'll let you know. No, just kidding. I moved. One important aspect is I moved from the engineering product team into the sales team, into the technical sales team. So that's a pretty big shift. And I'm responsible for the four big solution areas that we sell as a company. So that includes data and AI, apps and infrastructure, which together become what we know as Azure. But then also modern workplace, which is, you know, Office 365 and Windows, client, and then also business applications, which is our Dynamics product. So I'm sort of responsible for all of those, and that's the new gig.
No, it sounds like it's a lot of work, to be very blunt.
It's a lot more work than I want, let's be honest.
You're doing Microsoft solutions, other people are causing Microsoft problems.
That's right.
It winds up serving as wonderful balance.
That's right. I get called in. I'm sort of the fireman, as it were, but yeah, without any running water. So we'll see what happens.
So this morning, there was the Imagine Cup World Championship.
Yes.
Where you were on video from the expo hall, which looked like it was 30 feet away from where the rest of us were sitting.
Yeah.
And one thing that you mentioned was that it turns out it's the Microsoft mission statement, which I didn't realize companies still had, but you folks do, to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. Mm-hmm. Now, normally I tune out on those things, but you were wearing a t-shirt in the video, which is a bit of enough of a departure from what everyone else was wearing. Okay, I'm going to pay attention to this guy.
So he must know what he's talking about.
Exactly. If he didn't, no one would let him dress like this on camera.
That's right. Yeah, well, so the wearing of the t-shirt, I'll answer that question first, and then I'll dig in, because I think...
Start with the easy one.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, the wearing of the t-shirt, this has become sort of, in some ways, my brand, which is a little bit of a weird thing that you'd say your brand is that you wear t-shirts. But as I moved over from engineering to the sales organization, it was sort of like I continued to just wear t-shirts. And then it became sort of a thing that, you know, what funny, weird t-shirt is this guy going to wear, that now I have to wear t-shirts. It's really, I don't actually even have an option anymore, because everyone's like, you're wearing a dress coat. What are you doing, man? You look like an idiot. And so t-shirt all the time.
Right. You here to fire someone? What's the story? Oh, you're interviewing for another job?
Oh,
what's going
on? Exactly. I hope the interview went well. So that's kind of the thing with my t-shirt. So I have to continue to buy cool t-shirts. So if you've got any ideas, let me know.
Well, today was a plain gray shirt with no logo on it.
It was, which is a marketing thing. I had logoed shirts and they were all going to risk people suing us. So we ended up wearing blank.
Gotcha. So you fundamentally gave up on the whole NASCAR approach to business model.
That's right. So apparently no one owns plain gray. So that's good. So that's what I wore.
Yeah. I'm sure someone out there
is already filing suit. So then going back to your question about now that we finally get through that, we can talk about the mission statement. Yeah. So this is, it's actually really, I mean, I find the mission statement super, super inspiring, because it's, you know, what an interesting mission statement to be so focused on what we can help others to do versus what we ourselves are doing, right?
Right. Other folks' mission statements tend to be somewhat inward looking, like we're going to categorize the world's information
and
then
no
sell it
what that is.
Or we are going to not rest until no one else can make money doing anything.
That's right.
And it's great. This is a little bit more aimed at helping other people achieve.
That's right. And it's been one of actually the more exciting parts about moving in this transition. You know, when I was in the product team, I was out talking with customers a lot, figuring out what, you know, what they needed, what they were looking to do, how our products could help them. And this shift to the sales organization has been really pretty exciting because when you think of sort of a modern sales organization, it is not about how do I get in there and try and get you to sign this paper and give us a check, right? It's all about how am I helping you solve problems? How am I sitting down and understanding, you know, what issues you have and how we can bring the right resources from our side to partner with you? And there's been some like really exciting examples of this. I think we may have talked about it a year ago with Walmart. Some of the work we did, we've got sort of the joint development center with Walmart. We're doing really cool things with stores and IoT-based solutions with tracking sort of the health of their refrigerators. You know, there's been a lot of these really interesting opportunities for us to learn more about retail and them to take advantage of some of our deep technical understanding for the Azure services. And so when you think of the modern era of selling in the cloud, it really is around enabling and less selling, if that makes sense.
Which is interesting, just from a perspective of meeting customers where they are without feeling the need to be what your customer is. More or less providing services that help empower them to continue doing the thing they're already doing without a lot of the toil that goes into that.
That's right. Yeah, and in some cases, even doing things better, right? Or doing things more interesting. I think a good example also sort of retail is Kroger's. And right, they've added as part of their shelves, they have this product called Edge, and they add sort of an additional advertisement underneath like the chips to help you sort of decide which chip you actually want to go buy, which turns out is actually a really important problem that that we have to go work through.
Oh, if they can solve that one for me, that saves at least 40 minutes every week I go shopping.
Exactly. And so this is like a partnership with them to sort of solve this experience, this selling, buying experience in a new way. And so not only is it making existing problems solved in an easier way, but creating new solutions to problems that they didn't even realize they had. And so it's been really exciting to be a part of that and to be sort of at the front line of those conversations from the sales side.
Talk to me a little bit about how you're viewing the, I guess, world of hybrid, where people start off on premises, generally speaking. There aren't too many born in the cloud companies that have scaled out today on Azure that have been in Azure their entire existence and are now multi-billion dollar companies. Everyone has something legacy. There's always something that's vaguely greenfield. Last year, we spoke a little bit about Azure Stack. 12 months later, how's that going?
It's actually very exciting. I mean, I think we've seen a huge amount of interest and growth on the Azure Stack side. What we're seeing is that there's not only a lot of opportunity for these hybrid deployments for customers who come in and say, great, you know, I'm going to need both the cloud-based, public cloud-based solutions, but also something deployed locally. And it's not just because I used to have something locally, but because there's something that requires me to stay local. So I'm running a manufacturing plant, and I really can't depend upon the network to always be there. And so I'm going to have something local that will keep the manufacturing plant running, but then use the public cloud for additional data analytics, additional analysis, and so on. That combination of sort of intelligent cloud, intelligent edge has become a really interesting cornerstone of our overall platform.
Which seems critically important. We all have a story from somewhere in our past where we have a dependency built into something that's far away and remote. And invariably, the fiber line leading there encounters its natural predator, the backhoe. And suddenly, the entire factory is down for want of a single fiber connection.
Right.
And we have these agonizing stories that take 24, 48 hours to get resolved, during which time nothing happens. And the story of, oh, everything should live in the cloud, it should just be okay, simply isn't tenable when you're talking about significant volumes and significant scale here in the real world.
Right. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing this, whether it be network connection, whether it be local proximity, whether it be security reasons, having this combined solution is something that I think we really invented with Azure. And we're starting to see some of the other cloud providers actually come out with similar solutions, although I would still argue ours is both the best and sort of hardened.
Well, let's not kid ourselves. Of anyone who plays in this space, I don't think you'd be able to find someone who understands what it's like to deal with on-premise customer workloads for the past 40 years.
That's right.
Microsoft.
Exactly. We've got a little bit of history in this space.
Oh, yes. And everyone remembers those days with a smile and a wince.
Maybe a whimper, but hopefully that experience is turning into something very valuable to customers today.
Well, it does. People think I'm being sarcastic when I say this, and I may have said it to you last year, but Microsoft has 40 years of of experience in apologizing for software failures to customers, because in the cloud, things break. Computers fall apart. It's what they do. It's That's in their right. nature. And learning how to tell that story in a way to a customer that is first sympathetic and also aware of the fact that they are in pain and not blaming them for it
That's right.
is absolutely critical.
Well, and then always making the service better. This is the thing that I feel really passionate about, the opportunity to learn from both what customers are doing, how they're using our services, and even the problems that we have, and how to consistently make it better and better and better. That is one of the exciting parts of the cloud. In the history of on-premise software, it was a three-year cycle. 3 years later, things got better. Now it's 3 days later, right? And so the opportunity to sort of have that turnaround is really pretty exciting.
Yeah, the faster you can iterate forward and speed time to market, the more valuable it is for everyone.
Absolutely.
And increasingly, although not for everyone, of course, there's not as much business value as there once was in running your own data centers effectively.
Right.
And let's not kid ourselves, if you can't run a data center more effectively than I can with your resources versus my Twitter for Pets company of four people, there's a serious problem for everyone.
That's right. Well, and let's be clear, it's not me personally. I'm not actually in there running it. I don't think you'd want that. You may actually be able to do that better than
me.
Well,
Microsoft Solutions does feel a bit like a catch-all solution.
Right,
we don't
right.
know.
They call me in when the plug gets pulled out. Someone tripped on it. I plug it back in. But
and then you're the hero.
I am frequently the hero. That's right. As any good Corey would be.
Absolutely.
Let's be honest.
It's all in the name.
That's right.
It's our Corey competency,
it is,
one way
exactly.
or another. So Microsoft, in general, and Azure in particular, have an awful lot of services. During the keynotes today, first Satya's, and then I got to see Scott's as well, it went from, oh yeah, that's interesting, I've heard of that, I've played with that some, and oh, that one seems better. And then it sort of drifted into the realm of, I'm not entirely sure if you were having a joke at the audience's expense or not, where there's so many service offerings, it felt like I'd gone across the street to the Cheesecake Factory and started flipping through their menu with all of the different options you can go through. It's almost analysis paralysis.
Like a New Jersey diner. Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's overwhelming, and I've been using at least a few of these things for almost 30 years myself. So from your perspective, and I guess bounding into Azure, what are the major tracks of Microsoft offerings
today? Yeah. So when we think about it and we talk with customers about it, we do kind of split it up into two big categories, one being migrate, one being innovate, right? And when you think about what, again, coming back to what is a customer trying to accomplish, right? Are they taking deployments and they're trying to reduce some costs, they're trying to reduce some of the energy of maintaining it, then migrate's your path, and you're likely using something like infrastructure as a service, and then a bunch of the surrounding services, security, identity, management to sort of make sure you can run that infrastructure in a healthy and clean way. And then there's innovate, right? And a lot of the build talk track is around innovate for obvious reasons. These developers were sort of building new things. But then you sort of have a little bit of the data side and a little bit of the application side, right? Application side, we talked a little bit about two distinct services, App Service and AKS, our Kubernetes service, and really focused on those being sort of the cornerstone of the application side of the house. When it comes to innovate. And then, of course, data, quite a few services on data. One of the challenges with data in general is just how many different types of data opportunities there are in the world, whether it be NoSQL, whether it be SQL-based solutions, and then NoSQL, there's like a dozen of different ones who, you know, you find anyone on the street and they'll tell you, no, Mongo's the best. And then the next person will be like, no, Cassandra's the best.
And then you have people saying snarky things like, no, Mongo's great for your production data, not my production data. That stuff's important, but for yours, it's awesome.
That's right.
And it feels like the number one thing people love in that space is arguing about why other people are wrong.
That's right.
If there's one thing that's better than all else, it's being right when other people aren't.
That's right. That's why we do our jobs, isn't it? So we can relish in that experience. And so this is where, you know, some of the services that I think are really exciting, something like a Cosmos DB, where it ends up being multi-model, right? So Cosmos DB comes in and says, hey, look, we're a NoSQL solution. You choose the model you want. So you want Mongo, you want Cassandra, right? You want Gremlin. You can use it on top of this Mongo solution, and it all works, right? And globally distributed, et cetera. So it's really pretty powerful.
Do you think there's an architectural lock-in concern there?
Well, this is what's so beautiful about using those open source models on top of Cosmos DB. You can come in and you can code to Cassandra, which is not locked. I mean, it's not locked in anywhere. You can go and run it in any cloud. You can run it on premises. In fact, we have customers who are running on-prem and Azure using Cosmos DB as part of it, but you don't have to worry about the management. And so it becomes sort of, in my mind, the best of both worlds. You're not locked in. You've got this open source model that you're using, but you don't have to worry about management when it's run in Azure. And so in some ways, we're winning you over, hopefully, with the ease of use versus this sense of once you deploy here, you don't have any choice.
right? One thing you mentioned a minute ago, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said. We'll take it piece by piece. You mentioned that Build is aimed at being a developer conference, which is likely to raise an eyebrow or two from people in basically all of the tech cities that live on the coast that we all live in and we all know and love, in that, well, look at the customer stories you told. These were retailers, these were auto manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that something that gets lost in a lot of the conversation is that IT or engineering, writing software, is not writing Twitter for pets in the middle of San Francisco, where we've taken a job you can do from literally anywhere and built a land crunch in 8 square miles in an earthquake zone. Instead, it's now about things like a hospital in Duluth.
Right.
It's an insurance company in Omaha. It's companies that are doing real world things that aren't just creating this new data manipulation or tying APIs together and calling that a service. These are companies that do things that have business models our grandparents would understand, namely make more than you charge. And these are a business model that our grandparents might understand, where you make more money than you spend, and that's called profit, which apparently is a dirty word.
That's right.
It's neat to see developers who are writing quote unquote enterprise software are not being forgotten. If anything, they're being celebrated in the
story. That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And especially when you look at the breadth of different customers we had up there, right? We have obviously had a lot from Starbucks, then Virgin Airlines, right? The breadth of these types of customers and the problems that they're solving. One of the things that we talk about a lot inside the company is every company in the world is becoming a software company. Because every single company is now thinking about what is the software that we need to build to be able to deliver services to our customers. And so whether that be retail, whether that be manufacturing, whether that be financial services, there are all building and developing solutions. And that's why a developer conference includes folks from all of those industries across the world. It's a very exciting time to be in technology, frankly, because you're just seeing this really blossom. No matter what industry you're in, it's all about the tech.
Absolutely it is. Although I do question the validity of some of those demos. For example, you had Starbucks up there doing a whole demo talking about what they were doing with Azure, and they didn't mispronounce a single service name. They're Starbucks. Getting people's names wrong is their entire shtick. How I have to wonder how many takes it took to get them there. No, it's called Azure. No, that's not how you pronounce it. No, wrong company. Try again.
Now, remember that part of that problem may be the writing, the handwriting on the cups.
Mm.
So maybe when someone else wrote it, maybe they didn't have the same challenges that they have inside their stores. So that could be, maybe we figured something out here.
Cash invalidation, naming things, and renaming things. And hard problems.
In fact, that's right. Coming up with new names for sizes is definitely something that they needed a machine learning model for.
You talked a bit about Azure serverless databases as well on stage today, and you collectively, and which was fascinating in the idea of pay per second in return for performance, so it can scale down to nothing.
That's right.
Out of curiosity, something has stopped, you need to start it up again. Is that going to have a cold start issue? Is that going to just suddenly be there and ready to go through some sort of interesting caching layer? What's the story there?
Yeah. So the thing about both the serverless product and the hyperscale product, both announced today, very, very exciting, is they effectively separate the storage from the compute, right? And it allows a lot of things to happen. So on the hyperscale side, it allows you to scale horizontally as needed, right? So when you look at some things that you'd normally would be concerned about based on how much data you have, like taking a backup, right? Normally, when you're thinking about a database, you take a backup, you're suddenly like, oh gosh, you know, how much data do I have? How long is that going to take? Is it going to slow things down, et cetera? With the new ability to split and scale, suddenly that becomes a non-issue. And similarly with the serverless solution, it allows you to effectively separate out your data storage from what's going to run on top of it, things like backup or things like computational queries and so on. And so it allows you to split them apart and run them as needed. There won't be a cold start problem per se because it is still compute right nearby. But the key thing is the separation and then the scaling as needed. And so you basically can scale both tiers independently, which you think of a classic vertical database. You have that sort of scaling problem where one may scale more than the other.
And it also allows you to scale without downtime.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And so it on the hyperscale side allows much, much better performance, and on the serverless side can result in much better cost efficiency.
There was also an announcement today about aspects of your database offering being able to run at Edge and on ARM, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about that story?
Well, and so this is the ability to take SQL and run anywhere, I think, is a key aspect, right? And so one of the things that we launched, what, 2-3 years ago was SQL running on top of Linux, right? Which is a big step forward for the product. And so there's taking that product and be able to run in any form factor, right? Being able to run really, really small, being able to run really, really large, being able to run on Linux, being able to run on Windows, that opportunity to take SQL, it makes it much more portable, right? It makes it, it allows you to avoid, again, this lock-in point. You can take it anywhere you need it. You can take it and put it on an Edge device. You can take it and deploy it in the cloud. It'll work anywhere you go.
It seems like it's going to be unlocking a lot of interesting stories. Do you have any customer stories you can relate today, or is that still too early days?
You know, we have a lot of really exciting edge-based stories. Maybe not as many today yet that we're ready to talk about using sort of this new database offering with ARM, but quite a few examples where we have people doing super interesting things with Databox Edge, being able to do computation on the edge, being able to take sort of information running from drones and take cameras and being able to sort of do visual representation of those cameras. I think we demoed that last year as built-in edge-based functionality on those IoT devices. So there's a lot of opportunity here, and we're really just sort of scratching the surface at this point.
You also, I believe, announced today in early preview in a Databox Edge Heavy, which was, I didn't catch the exact numbers other than 650 pounds, which is a strange way for me to measure data storage, but I'll take it. What is the story there?
Yeah, I mean, we had a data box, which ends up being a way for you to take data, ship it to us, right? And we have folks who are doing that. And it's a, you know, portable, you can pick it up, a human can pick it up, right? And it's ruggedized, right? So you drop it, it's not going to be a problem and so on. But then we've now added this data box heavy solution, which is one of the more interesting names, I guess, we've chosen, which is not something that a human can pick up, right? It ends up being...
Well, not with that attitude.
Yeah. If you get in the gym more, maybe. But
exactly.
It's just a significantly larger device for storage and being able to basically transmit a ton more data right into the cloud. And so it ends up being a great opportunity for either solutions where the network isn't as rich or as open, or just the amount of data is so prolific that it just takes that type of device to bring it up there.
So how much data does that 650 pounds actually let me transport?
It allows you to transfer up to 1 petabyte of storage, and it's secure, right? So it ends up being encrypted as part of that transfer. So a lot. That's a lot.
Right. Not only is it going to be encrypted so someone can't steal data off of it, there's no way any reasonable person is going to be able to even lift it in the first place.
That's right. That's the 1 petabyte actually weighs a lot, apparently.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Is that not a measure of weight? I don't know.
It feels almost like it's a mind bender. How much does a petabyte weigh?
That's right.
And I'm betting that's a decreasing line over time.
But is it in a vacuum or not? I don't know.
That would be mass, not weight.
That's right. A petabyte of feathers versus a petabyte of stones. I think it's still a petabyte either way.
I think you're right.
That's right.
So something else that was released.
We've done some really deep thinking here today.
We really have.
It's been lovely.
Truly. Something that was mentioned about a month or so ago, as best I can tell, is the premium pricing for Azure Functions.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, you pay a little bit more on a per-function basis, and in return, you don't get cold starts. Things are pre-provisioned, which I'm of two minds on. First, it sounds great that you're able to pay a premium for a tier of offering that doesn't have a cold start problem,
yep.
And suddenly it's right there ready to go whenever something hits it. On the other, it does irritate me a bit to hear people devolve the serverless function discussion down into always talking about cold starts or not, because there are so many interesting use cases for this sort of thing that go well beyond someone is clicking in a browser and watching a spinner go until the site finishes loading. For that use case, yes, absolutely, this is awesome. Based upon what you've seen with people adopting Azure Functions in the wild,
yeah,
are you seeing that those are the primary use cases? Are you starting to see people use these as more back-end processing, where if it takes an extra couple hundred milliseconds to spin up, it's irrelevant?
Right. We are seeing a lot of both. So I think this is why actually having the two offers is so important for the customers who, to your point, don't really care about that immediate reaction time and really don't need it to be warmed up when someone clicks on it at all times. Having that sort of ability to just react and kind of do it casually, right? Casual functions, as it were, which is not the product name, but should be, I think. And so the backend processing, there's a lot of things, even like response to IoT-based actions, right? Where there may not need to be an immediate response, some sort of signal or some sort of information that has popped. And given there's typically a large amount of time just to get the information to you, a couple, like you said, even a couple seconds is not going to actually make a big difference. But in the cases where it is a human interaction, right, UX, clicking on buttons, et cetera, where it actually will change fundamentally the experience by adding 1 or 2 seconds, then you can pay a little bit of a premium and basically have that warmed up. And, you know, from our side, it's really just comes down to, are we starting it cold, quite literally from nothing, and we're just going to go spin up that function, or is it ready and waiting to run, and just perhaps taking a little bit less of that processing power, and so that allows us to have that different approach. So, I mean, I think we are seeing a lot of both. Certainly, a lot of the cold start is being used today, and I'm excited about this offering because I think we'll see a lot of that warm start now come through.
One last topic that I wanted to cover before calling it a show is the idea of lock-in. And people talk a lot about it, and often in some of the stupidest imaginable terms. And one of the undercurrents that I saw through both keynotes I saw today has been a repeated effort for Microsoft to reassure people that lock-in is not a concern. Everything is open. Whatever you put in, you can take out. And to me, at least, it always seems like a bit of a red herring concern, because even if you build everything in the most open possible way where you can take it anywhere you want in a day, great. No one is going to move $50 million worth of resources overnight anywhere, plus dealing with staff retraining or turnover as a part of that. Plus, while that's in flux, what happens? You can't generally take a multi-week outage for most use cases to do a migration.
Right.
Everyone talks about going significantly out of their way to avoid lock-in, but in practice, we're already locked in many cases by our own data gravity, by the choices we make around technology. How does Microsoft view lock-in?
Yeah. It's very interesting. I think when you really sort of dig into customer motivations and customer experiences, there's probably two different tiers of the way customers approach lock-in. One is at the infrastructure level. And to your point, there's a little bit of no matter what, right? Customers are locked into their on-premises database today in many cases, right? They've got the tooling, they've got the PowerShell scripts that work, they've got the processes that work. And so even moving to the cloud is breaking from that lock-in. Customers wouldn't probably call that lock-in, right? Because infrastructure management is infrastructure management. It's going to change, and you're going to have to learn it no matter where you go. And so to your point, there's a little bit of, there's sort of a baseline set of challenges just to move anything, period, right? Now, obviously, we want to try and make it as simple as possible. Solutions like Terraform can enable sort of a little bit of that mobility, but there is still a management aspect. There's a monitoring aspect. There are going to be some deltas even between clouds, even using something like Terraform to sort of offer a layer above.
And you're still looking at that point only using baseline primitive services. The higher level platform offerings are never going to be one-to-one compatible.
That's right. And so this is where, you know, I think when I think about lock-in and some of the approaches that we've taken with our platforms to minimize this as much as possible. The open source capabilities that we have on top of our PaaS services dramatically improve your ability to move if you want to. Right? And I think this is really where, when I talk with customers about lock-in, it's less around, I want to move every week back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. No, it's more, hey, I want the option to move if things go sideways, if it turns out our, you know, negotiations don't go well, or if I don't like you anymore, right? And so hopefully that's not true for us in any case, but the opportunity to say, and I don't want my developers to have to completely rewrite their app in those situations. And so yes, it's going to take work, it's going to be a migration cost, it's going to perhaps be a period of downtime to move things, but I don't want to have to go completely rewrite things. And when you look at some of the sort of classic examples of lock-in that really gets customers frustrated, and I'm not going to mention those customers by name here, the biggest concern is, I wrote an app, that developer has moved on, and now I have nothing that I can do to fix it other than perhaps hiring a whole bunch of new developers for. And so when you think of like our Cassandra support on Cosmos DB, Postgres support on SQL DB, Mongo, all those examples, they offer this portability that is an escape hatch. And that's actually really important for customers. The ability to say, look, you know, if you guys really screw the pooch on this, right, we have the option. And that is why I love those open source capabilities, even AKS, Azure Kubernetes Service. I love those open source options because something like AKS, fully downstream compatible. If you love our service, stay. If you want to use our serverless capabilities, stay. If you decide you actually want to move to somewhere else, it's fairly easy to be able to just say, great, I don't have to completely rewrite everything. It's going to be a very similar experience. So there's variances to this lock-in point, and I think our open source focus for a lot of our platforms, and then portability focus, even SQL is very portable, gives customers this option if they need it.
Yeah, it definitely seems like there's a long history of learnings that have helped shape a lot of the decisions Microsoft has made.
Indeed.
Just from talking to customers, seeing the pain and the suffering and the triumph and the tears of running infrastructures in the 90s and the early 2000s. It's strange in that, first, that's an incredibly valuable learning field. But secondly, I've got to say, I don't recognize the old Microsoft in what I'm seeing coming out of you folks today. And I think that's a compliment. But
I will take it as a compliment, whether you meant it that way or not. I think even as you going back to the beginning, right? Even as you talked about sort of our vision, it is a very new style of vision that really all we focus on is how we enabling others. It's very exciting. It's a great time to be in tech and a great time to be with Microsoft.
It certainly sounds like it. So if people care to hear more of your wise words of wisdom, where can they find you?
Oh, gosh. Twitter. If you want to hit me up on Twitter at Corey Sanders Waugh, W-A. That was originally Windows Azure, and then we rebranded, and I didn't change my name. So then it became Corey Sanders Washington State. Then I moved to New Jersey, and now I don't know what it is. So Corey Sanders W-A on Twitter. And questions, comments, people hit me up. And we have a show, actually, a Tuesdays with Corey show that you can find there as well. So
wonderful. And we will do our best to come up with a backronym for that Twitter handle these days.
Yeah, please tell me what it should be and I'll change it.
You heard him, Twitter. Thank you once again. I'm Corey Sanders, Corporate VP of Microsoft Solutions. I'm Corey Quinn, and this is Screaming in the Cloud.
This has been this week's episode of Screaming in the Cloud. You can also find more Corey at screaminginthecloud.com or wherever fine snark is sold.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.